So.
So the Western Mass Young Society, or Young Association, or whatever we are these days. Just a couple of announcements. John Peck, who's a wonderful analyst, will be doing a lecture next Friday in West Hartford. And you can go to the Connecticut Association of Jungian Psychology and find out more about it. We couldn't put it in our email because it didn't come in time. But he's excellent, and he's actually moving to Maine, so you may not hear him very much anymore in this area. So I highly recommend him. If you want more information about our programs, go to westmassjung.org. And I have a sign-up sheet for email if you want to be on our, if you aren't already and you want to be on our email list. We've done a couple of other things which we hope to continue in the spring. There's a Jung book group that we're kind of doing, we think. And there, she's in it. And Thayer Green did a wonderful 2-day intro to Jung course on 2 Saturdays. And so we're hopefully going to do a few other workshops like that in the spring. Turn on my glasses. You going to say something? Okay. So our next one is the first Monday in February, February 7th, and it's on Contempt and Shame, Archetypal Affects by Anita Green, who's a local analyst who many of you probably know. And just if you are, how many people are new today? Never been here. Good. Okay, great. We don't take a break, but there is a bathroom right there if you have to go. And we appreciate your donations. We appreciate $20 if you can. If you can't, we don't want you to leave, so give us whatever you can. But that keeps our organization happy and going. And the other thing I want to mention again, just to keep in people's minds, is that the Boston Jung Institute has an auditor program now, so that you can go and study, but you don't have to become a Jungian analyst. So you can take the first level of training, all the courses and everything, without going on. So just to keep that in mind. Okay. So tonight we have Richard Trousdell, who's a local analyst and has lectured in Greece and elsewhere. And he's a past president and on the board of our little Jung Association. And he's also a professor emeritus in theater at UMass. And his extensive knowledge of plays and writing, I'm sure, comes into what you do.
Thanks.
And my experience of Richard in working in the Boston Institute is that he's a man of very deep thought and clarity and sensitivity. And it's wonderful to work with him. So let's welcome Richard. Thank you.
Thank you, Erica. I'm going to try to be without a mic, but those of you in the back, if you would, because sometimes I forget and my voice drops, so just go, and I'll know that's here. Thank you very much for coming out in January to hear a talk about death. I think that's that says a lot, and I really appreciate it, and I hope it'll be worth your while to think about this subject together. I want to do a quick précis because some of it gets rather dense. And if it gets too dense, somebody wave a hand and I'll stop and try to clarify what it is. But I'll tell you basically what I'm trying to do. I want to talk about the values, perhaps, of approaching the idea of death consciously. It's not easy to do. It's something the mind rather quails at. But it's worth doing. Because in some sense, the more consciousness one can bring to the subject, I think there's a corresponding increase of consciousness comes about life itself. And it's rather like if you've had a near-death experience or you know someone who has, do you see what happens? Then usually what happens is that they come back into life more fully. They don't take it for granted quite as much. It somehow means something more to them. That's sort of the idea here. The main idea as well is that death is a metaphor for change, perhaps the most obvious metaphor for change. The life is there and then it goes. What happened? Where did it go? But we recognize the change, either if you've sat with someone dying, or those of us who have had to put down an animal, it's a terrible moment. You see life there and then it's gone. And that image lasts in us. It's an archetypal image of change that we project onto the seasons, for example, here in New England. But you can see it in all sorts of things. You can see it and feel it when a moment dies. I'm from the theater, believe me, I know when a performance dies. Relationships die. Some of them die a natural death. You know, they have a certain length of time, whatever that life was in them. Our attitudes about things die as we get on. And there, the image of death as change can be a positive thing. Many people worry if they have a dream of death in it. In my experience, that's not something to worry about. Usually what it indicates is some older attitude or something important is dying so that something else can come now into life. It's almost always a positive thing. And one of the founders of this group, Barbara Bronson, you all know Barbara perhaps, and she's not here tonight, but she's written a book about this, about dreams of death where it is about dying. The dreams are always positive ones. They're not of death, they're of transformation. They're of people changing or crossing over in some way. So anyway, a metaphor for change or for death. I'll be talking about this idea in several ways. I'm going to talk about it in terms of a wonderful Greek play, the Alcestis of Euripides, which is about death in a marriage, both a literal death, but also something that's died in the marriage that has to come back to life. So it's a wonderful play, and it's a very funny play, by the way, if you get to see it. And then I want to talk about it in terms of a client I was privileged to work with who chose to approach her death through her dreams. And she later wrote about this, so we can talk about it. Now, usually, if you work with a client, the material is confidential. Well, this person, her name is Mrs. Smith. Mrs. Smith, as you'll see, published a manuscript about her dreams, and so we can talk about them. And I think that's all I want to say. Now, I want to say a little bit about this, why this is up here. This is new. I just made this slide this week. Anybody have enough high school Latin to remember Mors, Janua, Vitae? Anybody?
Death begets life.
Sorry?
Death begets life.
Almost, that's right. Death. Janua is, we're in Janua. So one way you might translate is death is the January of life. But what it's a Roman aphorism. What it means is that death is the gateway to life. Now, I was struck by that because I gave the title of my talk, Death is a Threshold to New Life. So I didn't know it. I was stealing a Roman idea. And the word Janua for gate comes from the god Janus. We're in his month. January is named for the god Janus, the god of beginnings. We're at the beginning of a new year. We're in Janus mode. And Janus was a two-faced god in the sense that he looks both ways, like the song. I look at life both ways now. He looks both to the past, to the future, to the outside, to the inside. And Romans put his image on the threshold of their doors, their doorway, so that when you came into the house, Janus welcomed you home, and then you looked inward. And you see how that imagery develops. And when you went back outside, you left your inner world and you went to the outer world, and there's persona, there's Jung's idea of persona. You put on your persona, you protect yourself somewhat when you move out into the world. So I love the idea that we're in January, you've come out to hear about death in January. It's a new beginning. It's the beginning of, we're looking forward to spring. I was in a supermarket today. I almost, they had packages of seeds. I was going to bring them, but I thought that was too corny. Thinking about death and facing death is difficult. And I have this image up here. It's such a fabulous image of life and death. And it's by an Italian Renaissance artist whose name escapes me. Craig, help.
Is it Luca Signorelli?
It's Luca Signorelli. Signorelli, who inspired Michelangelo, as maybe you can see from his looking at the muscles in the body and so on. Well, this image was used by the novelist Zadie Smith in a wonderful article that it was in December. It's the December 3rd, or is it December 5th? Let me just see. Maybe I have it in my notes. Yeah, 5th of December, 2013, in the New York Review of Books, and it's called Man versus Corpse. And it's about her. She came home from a party. She was a little high. In the lobby of her building, there was this old art history book. She picked it up and was thumbing through it and came to this image, and it stopped her in her tracks. And what she tried to do was to imagine being that corpse. She was trying to, she said, it's very easy. We see corpses all the time, and anytime you turn on the television anymore, horribly, there are these images of corpses. But it's very difficult to imagine yourself as a corpse. She tried to do it, and she said, her expression is, my imagination quails at the prospect of imagining myself a corpse. Even my eyes cannot be faithful to the corpse. It takes monumental mental vigor to do it. She tried. And then writes this wonderful essay about approaching death and why it may be important. And it's just a beautiful article. And you can get it online, New York Review of Books, 5th of December. And I agree. And so, though I'll be talking about the Greeks and their ideas of... I'll be talking about their ideas of death, thanatos, and necessity. Death and necessity are almost the same thing. I think they're a little different. I'll talk about that. But death is necessary, the necessity of death. And I'll be talking about it. This is an image from Robert Wilson's production of the Alcestis. And that's Alcestis being taken away by death, but she's reaching back to life. She's reaching back to her life. And it's almost like a threshold there. So I'll be talking about that production. But the reason I use the Greeks, by the way, many, but one of them is they developed the first conscious attitude toward death that I'm aware of, and it was they had a sense of humor about it. And they're the first people, we're in their tradition, of course, we have them as kind of in our DNA. They thought that although death may be inevitable, it's not necessarily fatal. And they loved thinking of that way. They loved the wit of that. And the reason they did is they thought of wit as mind. That's reflective intelligence. And they thought that was your only protection against death. Your reflective consciousness. Consciousness is what makes us alive. And as long as we can bring consciousness to things, we remain alive. And if you can do it with a sense of humor, so much the better. Anyway, I don't want to start with a theory about death. I want to start with the emotions that Zadie Smith has already introduced us to when she said, my imagination quails at the attempt to be conscious about death. And a writer who's just published a new book about deaths said that most people trying to think about their own death feel something like panic. And there are actually some people who do feel panic. They, they need to put death out of their mind, or they just get too frightened. And I really respect that. That may be so. They're not ready yet to do it. But for me, the two words that come up emotionally for me about facing death, first is dread. I feel it here, that sense of dread. You know, I've had it a couple of times when you have to call the doctor back to get the results of the tests, and for just a brief moment you think, oh my God, what will I do if it's the worst thing? And you feel it. I feel it here, dread. And the other is how helpless it can make you feel, particularly if you're facing the death of someone that you love, or even an animal that you love. There's a terrible feeling of helplessness about it. And I want to tell you a story about it. I hope it's not too personal, because I want to make a point with it. My older sister, Carol, died about 10 years ago. And when Craig and I went out to say goodbye to her just before she died, I wondered how I would do it. How can I say goodbye to this person? So here was the last hour, getting ready to go, time to go. And I felt the dread of it. How do I say goodbye? And I felt totally helpless. What could I say to her to make her feel better, and frankly, make me feel better, make me feel less helpless? You've been in that moment where you just feel helpless. What can you say to someone who is either dying or has just had someone die? Well, I finally managed to say, Carol, you know, many people who have had near-death experiences, including Jung, by the way, said that towards the end, there's a feeling of light and lightness. And my sister, Carol, who was a former barmaid, looked at me and said, yeah, the light at the end of the tunnel. She made me laugh. That is so Carol. That is so our relationship. She made life happen again. Can you feel it? There's what the Greeks meant about the reflective intelligence is our only defense against death. She made life happen. She brought light into that moment. Not some ideal light beyond, but the little light of her mind seeing what was true and the present and saying it. And that's a very good example to me of why consciousness, if we can bring consciousness to the idea of death, we bring a kind of light to it. That's the hope in any case. All right, so far, is that idea a good place to begin? Good. All right. Let me see now. All right. I want to now go to two images of death, two Greek images of death. One's positive and one's very negative. And I think they represent our two polarities. We probably move back and forth between these two ideas of death. So here's the image of the first one. This is a good death. This is the death that the Greeks would call a kalos thanatos, a beautiful death or a good death. And what it represents is the god of death. Let's see if I can do this. There he is. This is Thanatos. You see, he was represented as a young man. And he's a kind of a soldier with wings. And he's carrying a dead body. And this is his twin brother, Hypnos, sleep. So right away you get the Greek thinking here that death and sleep are more or less the same thing. They're twins. They're the children of Mother Night. They come out of the darkness. So when we go to sleep, we're really already doing a little death. And then when we wake up, we're coming back to life and so on. Now, this figure that is being carried off, this is the guy who had a good death. And we're watching the good death in progress. This is Prince Sarpedon, who was killed at Troy. And what made him a great hero wasn't that he was, obviously he was not a winner, he lost to Achilles. Achilles was a much swifter killer than Sarpedon. What made him a hero to the Greeks is that he faced his death consciously. He didn't have to be there. He wasn't a Trojan, he was a Lycian. And he came because his best friend was Prince Hector. And he came for friendship, out of loyalty to friendship. And someone asked him, as he was going into that, what are you doing here? You don't have to be here. And he said, no, but look, I have to die. Why not have a good death? Why not have one where I'm dying for something? I'm dying for my friendship with Prince Hector, a noble man. And I'm dying for all those women and children and old people in Troy. I'm dying for a city. That's worth dying for. You have to die. If I didn't have to die, I wouldn't be here. I'd be home with my wife and children and my beautiful kingdom. That's what made him a hero for the Greeks, and why they picture him as a good death, a kalos thanatos, consciousness, meaning, dying for meaning, to make meaning, to preserve meaning. Later I'm going to talk about a modern hero who did that, and you'll hear how her meaning really has lasted and inspired people. It was a meaning worth dying for. In any case, he's being carried off the battlefield because he's Zeus's son. You know, usually if you got killed on the battlefield in the Iliad, your body was left there. And either the people who killed you would pillage it, you know, grab your armor because it was valuable, and poor Hector, they dragged him around and around the walls of Troy to show how he was dead, and we killed him, we're conquered, you know. Sort of like those awful people in Fallujah, you know. Some of our poor guys who peeing on a dead, that's what would happen if you were left on the battlefield. Or the vultures would come, or the carrion dogs would come and just eat you up. So it was very important to be carried off the battlefield. And because he was Zeus's bastard son, Zeus was always, you know, the king of the gods, had many mortal women that he had children with, and Prince Sarpedon was one of them. He wanted to save his life, but Zeus's wife, Hera, she always was getting Zeus. She said, no, you can't save him, he's mortal, he has to die. That's necessity, that's ananke, he has to die, he's mortal. But Zeus is always outwitting her. He's having him carried off the battlefield because in that way, his inner spirit, the Greeks called it psyche, our word psyche comes from it. It also means breath. They thought when you died, your last breath was psyche escaping. That his soul would then safely go to Hades. And that's why this is, you might recognize, this is Hermes, the psychopomp, the god who will transport Prince Sarpedon's soul to the next world, to Hades. Yeah? So here's a good death. And I think a little bit of this idea of death still lingers with us. Don't you think? We'd all like to have a good, brave death. We die meaningfully in some sense. God bless hospice. They try to make that so, that your death shouldn't just be clunk happen. It should be meaningful death. You should know the meaning of your death. You shouldn't just be left like a piece of meat to die. Yeah? That's kalos thanatos. Something else I wanted to say about that. Well, maybe it will come back to me. Consciousness and meaning are the two things I take away from this image of this wonderful vase, which, by the way, used to be in the Metropolitan Museum, but it was stolen, so it was sent back to Italy. You can still see it. It's in the Villa Giulia in Rome now. It's called the Euphronius Crater. There's a big wine bowl. The Greeks didn't drink their wine straight. They mixed water with it. You get a nicer high that way. It lasts longer. It's true. Now, here's an image of the Greeks imagined a bad death. Oh, I know what I was going to say. This is very important. Very often, we still hold up this heroic idea of death. And you see it almost every obituary, particularly if it's a cancer death, they say, fought the good fight, you know, struggled against, blah, 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 as if that's the only way to die. And that has caused a lot of harm. I think. Because there's some people who think they've got to hold on and fight long past where they should have, because they're afraid of leaving their families or leaving someone, or, and they really have to be told, and if it's loving, can say, you can let go now. We're okay, let go now. If there's time, I'll tell you a story about my sister that way. That's what they had to do with her. They had to say, Carol, it's time to go, you can let go now. In any case, that's good death. But listen, some people shouldn't be fighting their death. You know, shouldn't be. Just want, that's what I wanted to get in there. All right, here's bad death. Bad death was called kir, and in plural, the kires, and they were depicted as black winged figures. And we might, in our discussion, ponder why the image of a good death is masculine and why the image of a bad death is feminine.
Yeah.
And just what I said there about you don't have to get up and fight it, that's the masculine idea of death. There may be a more yielding, relational way to die that isn't up and fighting the good fight and having the umpteenth million operation that you don't really need. It isn't going to do anything. Yeah? Well, in any case, it was depicted by the Sphinx was a kir, the Furies, that's a Fury, the Sirens, those are Sirens. They were all images of a kir death, coming to steal you away. Or the kirs also would tear you apart, or scatter your bones. Or it was a terrible death. It was the death of losers. Right? And there's a wonderful description that's in the Iliad of this is how Patroclus, Harpies, that's the other one I forgot, are also an image of the kir death. Patroclus in the Iliad, when his ghost comes back, he says, the frightening kir, who got me by lot when I was born, has opened her jaws around me. So he's like swallowed by death, right? How's that for a nightmare image? That's that terrifying image of death that's just going to grab you and swallow you or chew you up or tear, and you'll just disappear. There's no meaning to that. You'll just go into darkness. There's nothing beyond. There's no life. No one's going to remember you. Your death means nothing. You'll just be swallowed. And for a Greek hero, that was a terrible thing. If you didn't achieve fame, that was a terrible thing for the Greeks. That's the worst thing. I don't know what your worst thing would be. But their worst thing was not achieving some kind of recognition. I'm old enough now where I'm starting to worry about it. I'm very glad Peter is doing the archives of this organization and is giving us all our recognition that we were here. I was here. Do you know what I mean? Okay. So there's, I think, the other attitude toward death, where you completely go unconscious. You know, you're swallowed. There's no afterlife to that. And I would say that this image particularly is something that's very meaningful to the Greeks, to us, from the Greeks, Jungians, which is that we always struggle with the darkness because there's a fear of going into the darkness of the unconscious. Jung was certainly afraid of it. He called it a confrontation. And he thought he was completely mad, but he stayed with it. And what he and Freud and the other early figures in depth psychology have done is shown us that we don't have to be afraid to go into the darkness. It's not going to swallow us like here or tear us apart, you know, psychotically. You know, you can go into the darkness and you can be held. Maybe, you know, the hope is that maybe something in the darkness will carry us. There's something in an inner part of us that will hold us and carry us if you go into the darkness of the unconscious. And not be torn apart like a kir. And the way Jung described this, he says it's like going, we're struggling for wholeness when we do that. We're struggling for the lost pieces of living psyche hidden in the darkness. the lost pieces of living psyche, our living psyche, hidden in the darkness. And Jung called those little pieces scintillae, little sparks of light, little sparks of potential mind, little sparks of light. If you, again, that image that mind and light are one, that you, what, every time you try to work with your unconscious images that you bring from the darkness in your dreams or however you do it, you're bringing little pieces of that mind into the light and making it real for yourself. That belief in that inner light of the mind, the inner light of psyche, helped Jung at a, you know, the proof of the pudding is when you have to eat the pudding, right? Well, he faced it when his mother was dying. And as we've all faced this one, you get called and you have to go back, and are they getting dead yet? No, they're not. And it turned out it was a crisis. She wasn't dead yet. This is 1923. And Jung was riding back on the train from the visit to his mother and is sleeping, and he had a terrible dream. The dream was that his mother had died, and on the one hand, he felt, of course, just torn apart by grief, just torn apart by it. But at the same time, he heard music and laughter like there was a party going on in the next room. Now, I'll let him describe how he worked with that, you know, such a jarring paradox. Here's what he's had to say. One side of me had a feeling of warmth and joy, and the other of terror and grief. The paradox can be explained if we suppose that at one moment death was represented from the ego, that is to say, from the conscious position. And our ego, by the way, includes our body. You know, we're embodied. Our ego is embodied in us, not just mind. It's our whole body is part of our ego. And the next from that of psyche, from the inner spirit, from inside. In the first case, it appears as a catastrophe, as if a wicked and pitiless power had put an end to human life. And so it is indeed, death, he means, a fearful piece of brutality, not only as a physical event, but far more so psychically. That's Kier. Can you hear Kier there? But from another point of view, that is to say from the psyche, from the soul, from the spirit, death appears as a joyful event. In the light of eternity, it is a wedding, a mysterium conjunctionis, a mysterious coming together, and I would say in this case of the opposites, but the opposites of the ego or mind consciousness, body consciousness with the spirit. When that happens, the soul attains, as it were, its missing half. It achieves wholeness. Can you hear? Body and soul are coming together, mind and spirit are coming together, life and death are coming together. I hope you still have the image of Janus in mind. The opposites in a present moment. Right? Because that's what Janus represents, the past, the present, and in between them, there, that's where we are right this very minute, present, somewhere between the past and the future. Well, here too, he's right on the hinge, right? That's where he's placing himself. And it comforted him. Now, I'm gonna. This is one we really need to talk about, I hope, in our discussion quite a lot, and I particularly want to talk about it because you know, how do you understand something like really that? You can get it, I think, intellectually, yes, right? You understand the idea, but when you try to put it into experience, in moments of experience, I hope we can hear something about that from your own experiences of this, yeah, or in intimations of mortality that you've had. No? Okay. Right, so let's see if there's anything else I wanted to get at for you there. Yeah. All right, I want to briefly, very briefly, just look at a Greek idea of, oh, I went too far,
I want to look at the Greek idea of necessity, because you'll come to see in a moment that it's very important to have that idea clear in your head. But I want to talk about what the Greek idea of necessity was. And it's very close to death, but it's not quite the same thing as death. Usually, when the Greeks are talking about an idea, they had this marvelous habit of personifying it, putting it into human form. You've seen Thanatos and Hypnos. Any idea, Eros, Venus, she was called, Spring, whatever idea, a trickster, Hermes, they put it in human form. So, as we would say, it's like an active imagination. So you can have a relationship with it. You can talk to it. You can try to see what it looks like. You're trying to visualize. You're trying to make it human. Bring it into your consciousness. I mean, death really, I don't think, looks like Thanatos. But it's one of the marvelous images of him, if you think of him that way. When Euripides puts him in his play, do you know how he has him? He has him like a bill collector. No emotion. No, I'm just here to collect the body. Sorry, it says right here they're dead. You got a problem with that? Well, when it came to necessity, the Greeks couldn't come up with anything. It was too big. It was beyond imagining. That's the most important thing about necessity. It's beyond imagining. It's that which you cannot think, and yet you know it exists. It's not meaninglessness. Meaninglessness is just, there's no meaning there yet. This has meaning, no question about it. Necessity has meaning. It's just meaning beyond what we're capable of easily imagining or seeing. So there are no images for it. It's also, again, feminine, she. They imagine it as she. It's the void. It's the dark logic out of which the universe spun. You know, have you done that when you imagine, where did I come from before I was? Where was I? Ananke. You're that void out of which necessity brought you here. Yes, you can talk about mommy and daddy and sperm and ovum and blah, 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 blah. Ananke, who is necessity, brought you here. It's undefinable otherness. Various philosophical interpreters have tried to say, they describe Ananke as constraint, that which constrains us. It's the limitless limit. It's the inescapable. It's this is my favorite one. That without which nothing else can be. You know, it's one way to describe God, isn't it? That without which nothing else can be. Don't fret that one too much, because even the best of the Greeks couldn't describe it. Here's Euripides, who was pretty damn good. Here's how he has the chorus and the Alcestis try to say what Ananke is. They're trying to comfort a hero who has just experienced it, you know, got kicked right where it hurts by Ananke and realizes it. And here's what they say. I myself have found nothing so strong as Ananke, nor any means to combat her. She alone is goddess without altar or image to pray before. There's no image for it. No place you can go to pray for it. She heeds no sacrifice. Don't bother. She's not going to listen. Even all Zeus, who is the king of the gods, ordains only with Ananke is accomplished. As we saw with Prince Sarpedon, even Zeus had to obey. Sarpedon, his favorite son and hero, has to die. Why? Ananke. It's necessary. And finally, they have this wonderful image, which I've put my, I'll show you my own image for this. Here's what the chorus finally says. By strength, Ananke folds and crumples steel. There is no pity in the sheer barrier of its will. that's what it feels like to me. You know, when you get to Ananke, all you can do is hang on. You know, that to me is somebody, that moment when all you can do is hold on. You're up against Ananke. Now, you could spill over into, why me? What? That's not accepting that it's necessity. It must be. Karen?
Is it different from fate?
Yes, it is. Thank you. That's a good question. Fate is, as opposed to a bad question. Sorry. I talk too long. It comes to you when you're a professor too long. Sorry. Fate is individual portion. It's called a moira. Your moira is your portion of whatever is. That's your portion. Like it or not, boom. It's yours, it's just yours. Ananke is bigger than that. It's everything. And it's easy to confuse them. Can you see the difference?
Yes.
Your individual portion is what you got. Ananke is what happens to you. And it's what generated a you. Generated a fate. You see? It's bigger. Okay. And notice that there's no empathy. There's no pity, they say. There's no pity in Ananke. So whenever you run up against a situation in which there's no pity, it may be Ananke. Now, it's tricky because even death, you know, is necessary, but we're pushing back against it, aren't we? Think of all of the transplants, chemotherapies, you know, we're always pushing against necessity. I think that's important. Because otherwise you just say, it's necessity. Wait a minute. Was Columbine necessity? How about gun control? Was 9/11 necessity? There was no pity in it. Was that necessity? Maybe, but do you see what I mean? It's good to have the concept. It's good to question it and to push against it. And I think we are. And that may be one way to think about the expansion of consciousness that Jung says is so important. Well, not surprisingly, Ananke was first imaged this way, not in human form. It was imagined as a serpent surrounding a cosmic egg. And that's a very, you know, we could go on about that image forever. But I, you know, immediately I see the egg of potential life constrained by Ananke. And yet Ananke is flexible. If it's a snake, it has a kind of energy that's flexible. That's an awfully big egg. Has it been pushing against Ananke as human consciousness expands? Maybe. I also see sperm and ovum. That without which nothing else can be. Okay, there's a little bit of Ananke. As you'll see, Euripides thinks marriage is Ananke. Because it's a coming together of opposites. That without which nothing else can be. You see? Maybe a form of necessity. You thought it was just your beauty and wit and intelligence. That might have been a knock. Right. So now I want to go to Euripides and the Alcestis, and then I'll go to case material. How are you doing? It's almost an hour. Are you all right? Do you need a stretch or something? Okay. Who is the wonderful Canadian analyst? Gosh, I've lost her name.
Marianne Woodman.
Marianne Woodman was a theater teacher as well as I. And I'll tell you, in fact, let's do a Marianne Woodman. She said, no human beings can sit listening to another human being for over an hour. Some part of you, usually the mind, will go to sleep. So what? And now I'll ask you to do it if you can. If you can't do it, don't worry about it. She says, we're all going to get up and do the washing machine. If you can. If you can't, don't worry about it. All right, here's Marianne Woodman's washing machine. And you can do it in your own speed. And just let your body go with it a little bit. Put your backs out. Don't sue me if you do. And then anything else that you feel you want to do.
Isn't she wonderful? Isn't she right?
Exactly.
All right, so now I'm going to do, just so you see where we are, in the sort of rough out that I gave you at the beginning. That's the intro, sort of the basic, some of the basic ideas. I'm now going to go into the play, the Alcestis, and then I'm going to go to case material, and it's all part of this idea of the consciousness, making death conscious, trying to be conscious about death can bring new life in some form. Yeah? All right. So, now for the Alcestis. We've already seen what the Greeks' idea of a good death was. It was a hero on a battlefield dying consciously for a value. Euripides celebrates a new kind of death, one not on a battlefield by a warrior, but in a marriage by a woman. And he is unique in the history, in Western history, is that Euripides is the first one who's trying to consciously, in his work, over and over again in his plays, is trying to show that crossover from a masculine way of thinking to what is that same set of ideas from a feminine point of view. So he's looking at a heroic death, but now from the feminine. Not a brave death, logos-oriented, masculine form of up and fight death, but working with death in an accepting way. A feminine, what we characterize as a feminine way, yes? We still have that Greek habit of thought. Some of us, I know, are trying to change it and are looking for other images of that opposition, but it's the vocabulary we have, so we use it at the moment. Now, as soon as you do that, you move from battlefield to bedroom, you're moving from the field of outward struggle to, yeah, we're still going to talk about death, but now we're going to start talking about inward deaths. We're going to talk about death in a marriage. We're going to talk death in the bed, bed death. We're going to talk about relationships dying. We're going to talk about feelings dying. We're going to talk about the ways in which we're connected to one another. That isn't just struggle. Sometimes we're connected in other ways that are real. We don't have to just be physically struggling all the time to see our relationships. We can struggle in another way and also come together in another way. You know, many, many people, including Robert Wilson, whose work I illustrate a lot, realize that in some sense, the battlefield death is an erotic thing. Do you know what I mean? There's an erotic part of battle, penetration. Coming up. Do you see what this? They're not crazy. There's a lustful quality often to battle, a turn on to it, in fact. But anyway. That's another story for another day, but what I want to point is this movement that Euripides is making towards the domestic, towards looking at death from a domestic point of view. And what he's interested in particularly, that if partners are connected, not just in body, it's not just that kind of a conjunctio, but in spirit and in soul and emotions, there's an emotional joining. Then if one dies, what happens to the other? Do they die too? And that's what the play is going to test out. So let me say what happens in this bedroom drama of the Alcestis. Here's the story, briefly, of the play. There's a young... This is a husband and wife joined together in more than one way, not just physically. Yeah. Joined together in body, but also these images from alchemy show also joined together in spirit. See the dove above and the sun underneath consciousness and the unconscious and
you know, we're joined together in all these ways with our significant others. And anybody who's really been in a close relationship knows this. You are bound together in all sorts of ways. And Euripides is going to use this image of a yoke to express that relationship, that you are yoked together in some very meaningful way. And it's very important that the word anankate comes from Semitic languages into the Greek. And it originally meant a yoke. So in some sense, we are yoked to necessity. Even Homer uses that expression. We're yoked to necessity. And for Euripides, marriage is one of those yokes. Right? Now, the play concerns a form of necessity. The play concerns this young hero. His name is Admetos. His name in Greek means not yoked. Ah, Demetos. He's not yoked. Not tamed. If you think of an animal, when you put a yoke on an animal, you tame the animal. And a lot of married men feel that way. Oh, God, I got yoked. I got tamed. I think a lot of women feel that way, too. I got hooked. I got trapped. I got yoked. Euripides means it in more than just the physical way, as you'll see. In any case, here's the story. This young, unyoked guy is fated to die. He's the king of Pherae, and he's supposed to die. It's his fated time. It's Moira. But he's loved by the god Apollo. The god Apollo loves him because when Apollo was in trouble with his father, Zeus, he was enslaved to Admetus, and Admetus treated him decently. He treated him like a good host would treat a good guest. He didn't humiliate him. And Apollo is so impressed by that virtue that he feels bound to him. He feels he's got to do something for him. So he tries to intervene to prevent his death. And he does it by getting the Fates drunk that we were talking about earlier. The Fates are these three sisters who spin our lives, spin the thread of our lives, how long it's going to be, and then when they think it's enough, they cut it. That's the end of your line. Well, Apollo gets them drunk. So there's an idea that you can become unconscious about your death with a drink or two. You can delay awareness of how sick you are, dead you are spiritually or whatever way. But here's the deal. What the fates agree to is that if somebody else is willing to die for Admetus, he can live. If not, he's got to die. So Admetus then tries everybody he knows. Here he is facing his death. That's death down there. That's Thanatos in a Robert Wilson production. And there's Admetus facing Thanatos and asking everybody, will you die for me? And of course everybody says no. Including his father. His father is one of them. He says, listen, I gave you birth. Why should I be take on your death, too? That's your business. And Admetus curses his father. Curses his mother. Curses his friends. You can see he's really a sweetheart. He's one of the most unpleasant heroes in Greek tragedy. Mysteriously, it always has seemed a mystery to me, one person does agree to die for him. His wife, Alcestis, she agrees to die for him. And she does. And I want to question that for just a minute, but I don't want to give the game away, but can you guess what's going to happen when you allow somebody else to die for you like that? What happens if you let somebody else consciously die for you? Die your death for you.
I'm overcome by guilt.
You are overcome by guilt. After they're dead, oh my God, they're dead because I didn't do something. I should have done. Oh, if I just called a minute sooner. If I didn't leave that on. Oh, if I had really checked whether I cooked that meat completely. Guilt. Yeah. And shame. Everybody looks at him and says, well, You let your wife die for you. Terrific. What a great guy you are. That's what's going to happen. And so the irony of the play is that he dies right on schedule. He just didn't die in the form he thought. His physical life goes on. His daily life goes on. He dies spiritually. He dies socially. He dies in all think of all the ways you've died already. Humiliated. Remember dying through humiliation? All the ways he dies all those deaths. And what happens to Alcestis? She becomes a hero. She becomes like Prince Sarpedon. She's going to be honored. She's going to have a tomb built. She's going to be famous. She's going to become what the Greeks called a daimon, a blessed spirit. That was also their word for a hero. A hero was a blessed spirit. That's what he's going to find out. And that's the story of the play, really. But I want to come back for a moment and question Alcestis' choice. You know, as a therapist, if you had a client who told you, my husband's supposed to die, but if I die for him, I'm going to die for him. Well, actually, we meet people like that who have died for their spouses. And you say, hey, wait a minute. Should you totally be dying for your spouse? Shouldn't some of you be living too? You've totally sacrificed yourself for your children? Totally? How about you? Where's your... Yeah. Also, if a client came in and said they were going to sacrifice their lives, I would also worry about suicide, wouldn't you? Self-destructiveness? So, you know, you worry right away, is Alcestis self-destructive? I'll tell you what her father-in-law thinks when he denounces his son. He says, oh yeah, I know, women, you got her all hot and bothered, she's in love with you, she's going to kill herself for you. He thinks she's deluded. She said she's love deluded. You know, she's been manipulated emotionally. So I want to question her dying. And I want to come to a moment that is remarkable, but Euripides stresses it. He puts the biggest messenger speech of the play, a description of Alcestis preparing to die. Consciously. Articulating meaning. Again, like Prince Sarpedon. And here's the way her maid describes her. She wept, not at all, made no outcry. The advancing doom of death made no change in the color and the beauty of her face. Does that really happen? Do people really die like that in their right minds? Well, I have a description that comes from a description of that psychoanalyst Heinz Kohut. Do you know him? He's self-psychology, Heinz Kohut. He's a great thinker and developed the whole field of self-psychology, yes? And he's parallel to Jung in some ways. He believed that there was what he called a nuclear inner self that's comparable, but not really, but somewhat comparable to Jung's idea of the inner self, psyche. Anyway, Heinz Kohut was fascinated by people who died this way. And he's written about it. And I can tell you the name of the book. It's called Self-Psychology in the Humanities by Heinz Kohut. And he wrote about a group of students. Here they are. These were students at the University of Munich in Germany during World War II. You can see one of them. Hans Scholl there, he's in a Wehrmacht unit. He was actually a soldier. He was actually in the German army. But these students at the University of Munich, fairly early in the war, turned against Hitler. They realized that their country was in the hands of a tyranny and a madness, and that they were possessed, that the country was possessed by Hitler's madness. And they publicly demonstrated against Hitler and passed out flyers and so on. They knew they were putting their lives at stake. But they thought that their country needed an example of people standing up and saying, this is madness. We're possessed. Stop this. And it's called the White Rose Movement. And needless to say, they were all arrested and guillotined. How's that for the image? Cut off their heads. Most people in Germany were being hung. They were guillotined. is a particularly horrible punishment. I'm happy to say, by the way, as a member of the teaching profession, that not only these students, but their professor, who was a professor of philosophy, was also stood up and was executed. In any case, Heinz Kohut tries to get inside their motivation psychologically, and he says that their calm self-sacrifice grew from a narcissistic balance in the personality. Narcissism has a bad name, right? If you're narcissistic, you're stuck on yourself, you only regard yourself. But there's also healthy narcissism, which is a healthy self-regard, a healthy sense of your self-worth. So a narcissistic balance is a narcissism that's balanced with something else. And in this case, Kohut says that narcissistic love of yourself is balanced by what he calls the ideals in the nuclear self. Their ideals balanced that narcissism and allowed them to die for values they believed in. That's how he tries to understand it psychologically. And as an example of it, he cites this a dream. And, you know, Jungians really, that's central to our work, dream work. And I'm so grateful, A, that this dream was preserved, and that, B, he quotes it. The dream is by this young woman in the center. Her name is Sophia Scholl. She was 19 years old at the time of her death. And on the what everyone noticed about all the White Rose kids when they were students, when they were getting ready, is how good-natured they were. They had a sense of humor. They were calm. They even respected the people. They felt sorry for the people who were having to do what they did to them. People were unnerved by the way they behaved. And here is the dream that Sophia Scholl had, and she reported it to her cellmate the morning of her execution. She had it the night before she was guillotined. Here's the dream. In the dream, Sophia Scholl said that the sun was shining as she climbed a mountain. And she's carrying an infant in her arms, dressed in white, towards its baptism. Suddenly, a crevasse opened before her so that she just had time to put the child, as she said, on the other side before she herself fell into the crevasse. And what she said to the person to whom she reported the dream was that child represented our idea, unsere Idee, that would survive despite all obstacles, wird sich durchsetzen. Our idea will survive. Now, when I read this dream at a conference in Greece, and Donald Kalshet was in the audience, and his comment afterwards was, that child she carried was her immortal soul. That's, you know, Donald's work, how he would think of it that way, as her immortal soul. Now, I want you to hear how people described Sophia Scholl on the morning she died. And if I can find it, here is her description, and see if this sounds familiar to you from what Euripides said of Alcestis. She was calm and peaceful. Her skin was glowing and fresh, her face radiant. Her lips were of a deep glowing red. She was without a trace of fear. Let me read Euripides' words again. She wept not at all, made no outcry. The advancing doom of death made no change in the color and the beauty of her face. Now, it's very interesting that when Alcestis died, like Sophia Scholl, she prayed for her children, that they would survive her, and that she prays to Hestia, who is the goddess of the home and the hearth. She prays that they'll have a good marriage, that they will be yoked,
Did I have it? Yoke? Did I have a yoke image in there? I thought I had it. Well, anyway, imagine a yoke.
They would be yoked. They would be yoked to good partners as she was. So can you hear surviving values in your child? There's a little bit of your extension into life beyond your own life, in your children, in the hope that they'll carry certain values forward. There's one belief of death given into life, gone into life. I think maybe that's enough for the moment about the Alcestis. I do want to say that finally, you know, the test here is Admetus there going to live up to this ideal that she's dying for? And the answer is yes. There's this big scene of anagnorisis as a recognition. When it finally comes crashing in on him, all the things that we've already said, you know, what he's lost, including any sense of being alive. And we would say, as Jungians, we would say he's come to recognize that in losing Alcestis, he lost his life, he lost his soul, he lost his anima, he lost his connection to life. And he realizes that now. And in this way, he's come up against necessity. And it's at that moment that the chorus says that wonderful speech about a necessity. I don't know what it is, I can't describe it, but you're at it, baby. This is necessity. Suck it up. Hang on. Okay. Before then, by the way, he's really a very good example of what you're like when you're not. We are like when we're not accepting necessity. A crybaby. Alcestis is dying. He says, "Why are you leaving me? What are the children gonna do?" He hasn't. And she says, "Admetus, you can see how it is with me." She's faced necessity. "You can see how it is with me." Have you not said that to your spouse sometime? Okay. Now I'd like to go to the case material, to this wonderful person that I had the privilege of working with, and her approach to her own death. And here she is, and I can tell you her name. Her name was Elizabeth B. Smith. She went to Smith, by the way. There's an image of her at one of her Smith reunions in old age. And she wrote this wonderful book called In the Company of Dreammakers. She felt that we didn't just have dreams, we made them. The psyche gives them to us, and then we make them by working on our dreams. Yeah? And so she wrote this book so that there would be, that's us, a company of dream makers working on our own dreams. And the best way to, well, now I need to tell you just a couple of things about her. What you really need to know is she was born and raised in the 30s and 40s, and she came to maturity in the 1950s and 60s. And she achieved a lot, a superb education through the doctoral level, a successful international administrative career, and a solid marriage in which she helped raise two accomplished daughters. But she had to fight to achieve all that, as you can imagine, breaking through the familiar glass ceilings of academic and professional life. But she did it in the 50s and 60s. Right? So she's a pioneer. And she also had to confront conventional fears and criticisms of what she was doing, including her own self-criticisms, that a good mother's place was in the home, not in a graduate school or in a career. But she did it anyway. She had the discipline and talent to do it, but, as you can imagine, with a lot of conflict, a lot of struggle, and doubt. People look like yours, but they have doubts. You know, I think of Nelson Mandela. There must have been moments he had terrible doubts. What he showed us finally, you know, looks, I'm clear, but, you know, I think how hard he must have worked to get that clear. What he had to suffer, mistakes made, and so on. Anyway, I want to introduce Mrs. Smith now as the way she would want to be introduced, by a poem that is the preface to her manuscript. It's a poem that she wrote that is the preface to this manuscript. And it's called Another Icarus. Do you know the story of Icarus, son of Daedalus, whose father makes him wings made of wax so he can fly out of the maze, but warns him not to get too close to the sun? Of course, like every teenager on his first vehicle, doesn't die. Gets too close to the sun, the wax melts, he falls to earth. So Mrs. Smith is identifying herself with Icarus. She's another Icarus, she thinks. Here's her poem. Oh, endless universe, it's you I need. I must have all your space through which to fall and never know where I might light. Light in this sense, it's a wonderful play on words, but light means light, you light on something, like a bird lands, lights on a tree, but also light, where I might light. To fly from nests, they say, brings joy to life, not to return. And so far I agree, that I would fly into the heat of suns, to lose my wings, to fall, but then to miss the sea. Indeed, to miss the earth and yet to find the universe sufficient for my state of mind. Now, you know, it's very easy to pathologize that poem. You know, as a knee-jerk Jungian, I can remember thinking, oh, that's Puella inflation, or animus possession, or you know, some of that, but it's not. Nor was it a wish to die. It was just the opposite. So it's expressing a wish to live more fully and to find an inner universe, to fall into an inner universe beyond ego that would satisfy the yearnings of her mind. And as you'll hear in her dreams, what she was looking for was a kind of psychological balance between ego consciousness and an inner self that both Jung and Co have described. That's the balance she was looking for, a narcissistic balance. That, I want to remind you, Jung says that's the only way we really can come mentally to terms, psychologically to terms with death, is to find that balance between our ego consciousness and our inner soul or spirit. That's where the balance needs to be struck. If you can find it. So now I just want to read two of Mrs. Smith's dreams. How am I doing on time? I'm good. Because I hope to leave a good half hour for you to give your impressions or experiences, particularly of these ideas. Because until they're real in us, they're just ideas. Do you see what I mean? Yeah. I want to read just two of her dreams. Her initial dream, which, as many of you know, Jungians pay a lot of attention to initial dreams for a simple reason. We don't feel like we're doing the analysis. Psyche is doing the analysis. And if somebody dares to bring their psyche to us, we're pretty sure psyche has prepared them that first dream will be very significant. It will probably give us a pretty clear picture of what's going on. It will also maybe predict a direction in which the work is going to move. Psyche is doing a large part of the work. We work in psyche. We work in that psychic field. So here's Mrs. Smith's initial dream. I was a high wire performer, doing my act on a unicycle with only a bamboo pole for maintaining balance. Here, listen for that word, by the way. Maintaining balance. And no net to sustain me should I have begun to fall. As I approached the midpoint on the wire, there was a sudden burst of applause, which was inexplicable by any dramatic change I had employed. I searched in the darkness ahead of me. A blinding kind of light, a brilliant light, was aimed at me, and suddenly out of its darkness appeared a clown, barefoot, carrying only a tiny paper parasol, which he playfully carried as if it were a serious balancer. The audience was applauding as he somersaulted so very cleverly to everyone's delight, except mine, for as he approached me, he showered me with looks of murderous hatred. It was evident he was out to tousle me. That's an old-fashioned verb, tousle. You know, you tousle someone's hair? Well, he's out to tousle me off balance and to send me flying into the dreadful darkness below. And like a cure death, the dream ended as a kind of nightmare. She's going to be swallowed by darkness. You know, this brave vaunting, I'm going to fall. That's what the fear was. There isn't going to be anything there. So a lot of this dream is, a fairly accurate feeling toned or emotionally toned picture of Betty Smith in her life, that high wire performance she did on her own up there without any safety nets of support or social approval. That's what she did.
It's Icarus again.
And it's Icarus again, absolutely. Absolutely. And she dared to do it. And here she is at the end of her life trying to think, what does my life mean? Is this what it meant? It's also important to know that she worked, before she worked with me, she worked with a very famous analyst, Dr. Hans Westman, and he's written a book. His big thing was the New Testament, working with him. And he was an associate of Jung's. He worked with Jung. And he was famous in Jungian circles for being a clown trickster. In fact, she told me a story about Dr. Westman at a Uranus conference, you know, these conferences that were held. I think it's in Italy, is it, Karen? Yes. It's in Italy. And it was a conference that Jung was at, and Hans Westman was there, and evidently someone was up there boring everybody to tears, and Westman couldn't take it anymore, and he got up and he left, and there was a terrace, and he went out, and he came back wearing one of those beanies with propeller in it, and put his face up against the terrace door to make everyone laugh. So that, you can hear how that clown figure, where that comes from. So, anyway, there are a lot of things to say about the dream in addition to what it shows us. Was there a universe sufficient, or was she just going to be mocked? The thing I most want to focus on, I mean, there are many, many things to say about this dream, but what I want to focus on is what it implied about the work that we were going to do. Could you hear that she was coming doubting the work she had already done, and doubting the work she might do with me? She was testing me. Was I a serious balancer? Was Jungian work a serious balancer? Every Jungian I know has come to that moment, in themselves as well as others. You don't just get assurance and stay there. Doubts come. You wonder, is this work really? Am I making this up? Is this true? Is it? That's working for the serious balancer. Was it just airy pretension? You can see how you can go on with that. It just needs to be brought down, get grounded. Well, for me, the question was, could she come down from the high wire of the ego's willed achievement, which she certainly did, to trust her psyche's ability to catch and hold her and to gather up lost pieces of her soul? Was it just going to be this, right? Or were there lost pieces there to bring up that would hold her so that she would trust psyche holding her, her inner world holding her as she faced her death? And I want to point out that the costs of what she did have been extremely high. She got a lot of rewards, but there were extreme costs to it. And the question is, was it worth it? What was that? Would that be recognized? So now I want to go to her final dream, which came almost 9 years later, by the way. We worked together for almost 9 years. And we looked at a lot of the things that it had cost, by the way, the entire time, as you can imagine. And here's her final dream. In the dream, she's back in her childhood home, stepping outside. I'll now quote her. "Yes, I was stepping outside my attic window onto the graceful branches of a sturdy pine. I was out without worries because I knew I was to be buried in this tree and otherwise prepared for rebirth. Mother was waiting below on the terrace. She watched and readily stretched out her arms to catch me when I came into her reach. She observed the easy flow of my body into her possession. She insisted on arranging for the design of a brass plaque to be placed on the bark of the pine tree. She wanted the world to know about the special gifts the pine presented. By the safe procedure of moving me from branch to branch, the tree deserved all the credit we could muster for it, as well as all the publicity throughout the whole world to whom this story was to be told." Right. And here we're telling it because she wrote it down so that we could share it. Now, she didn't need me to tell her that the tree she was descending, she was very well read. She not only had a thorough Jungian analysis, she did a lot of reading. You know, she often knew more than I did. By the way, she was my first client.
Wow.
Wow.
Oh, yes, Mrs. Smith.
She didn't need me to tell her that the tree she was descending was the tree of life, as well as the analytic tree of inner knowledge. Nor did she need to explain me to explain the pine tree's connection to the goddess Cybele, the great mother, that archetype. She'd seen all of that for herself. She knew it wasn't just her mother's arm she was descending it into. She knew it was also Cybele. Her own mother actually was quite critical of her. Mm. Yeah. But now she's waiting, you know. The mother has been redeemed as well as she's being redeemed here. So what I did help her to see was how her dream fulfilled her unconscious longing. I want to stress that. Her unconscious longing. She didn't know she had this longing. For an honored initiation into her spiritual wholeness as a person and as a woman. She had never had that initiation. Her own society, her own mother had not been able to give her that. That's what's happening here. An initiation that the great mother archetype was now witnessing and celebrating. Mrs. Smith, from my point of view, was coming down into objective psyche's welcoming embrace of what was simultaneously her death and a rebirth, into a trusted symbolic universe sufficient for her state of mind. She loved this dream. She called it her sign-off dream. And it was. She knew that there wouldn't be anything that she would want to do beyond that dream. And she told me, she said, "This is my sign-off dream, so I'll be ending now, thank you." And she did, ended. And I think you can guess she was also very close to her death. She did die within a month of having this dream. She knew it. Okay, well, I think I'll just go to discussion here. I have another part here, but I'll just tell you what its message was. Jung tells us to distrust endings that are too neat. You get to them, you get to moments of realization, and if you think that's your sign-off, forget it. It's not. If you go on living, there's another mountain. There's more stuff for you to do. There's a reason why you're going on, presumably. So I just want to say that. That ending's a it was a perfect ending for Mrs. Smith. She worked darn hard to get it. She worked her whole life to get it. She earned it. But I want to say that insights come, but then they go, right? These big moments of anagnorisis. And I was going to show you how Euripides has fun with that, too. I'll just show you the images. I won't even use the words. Here's what Euripides does to this big moment. Boop, boop. 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 You're yoked, that made us boop. So I think that's enough. You had enough of me. I've had enough of myself.